This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on December 7th, 2017. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
It'll take just a minute. One of our commissioners is just working and ready to go. Good morning. This will convene the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, December 7th, 2017. We're working off an amended agenda. At the beginning, I'd like to welcome our visitors from Moldova. It's a nice honor to have you come and visit with us and watch our process. Hopefully, you can teach us and we can have a mutual education program going on here and we'll learn from each other. I had the privilege of being able to visit and observed your last election, so and I understand you have one coming up. So I hope all is going well, and we'll talk to you today and tomorrow. Of the three people, there's Anastasia. Forgive me if my pronunciation is not so well, but Antochenia, something like that. Lori Kurtu, and Vyacheslav Diogasenko, something like that. Thank you. The first item is resubmission audit, division recommendation memorandum on the New York Republican Federal Campaign Committee, NYR A13-11. Ready to proceed?
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
Before you is the audit division recommendation memorandum on the New York Republican Federal Campaign Committee. The findings consist of, number one, misstatement of financial activity, number two, record-keeping for employees, number three, disclosure of occupation and name of employer, number four, reporting apparent independent expenditures, and number five, record-keeping for communications. The defer was approved by the Commission on August 10th, 2017. We are available to answer any question. Thank you.
Thank you. Any discussion? Mr. Goodman.
Yes, I was a little confused. This issue comes up quite often, as you know. People run, state parties run volunteer mail programs. They don't always keep all of the records. But we have credited affidavits in the past that make blanket representations under oath. I'm not sure who I direct this question to. Yes, ma'am. Why aren't we crediting the affidavit of the state party's counsel that said that all of their mail in this election cycle was conducted pursuant to the volunteer mail exemption? Why don't we credit the representation that they only ran one type of mail program?
Commissioner Goodman, I'm Nicole Burgess. We did not give Mr. Previtt's affidavit. We didn't recognize it in the report. However, when the committee submitted their affidavits, they submitted them all in packets from the vendors, and they attached the associated mail pieces along with the invoices. I brought them along. So they came in a packet as such, and the invoices as well as the individual mail associated mail pieces were all attached, and the affidavit stated that they were attesting to the attached invoices and mail pieces. So, as an example, this is an invoice from affidavit invoice packet from Atlas Direct Mail, and in this packet, we have all of the associated invoices and mail pieces that the vendor is attesting to. However, the 236 that was mentioned in the ADRM, of that amount, 91,000 included pieces and invoices that were related to Atlas Direct Mail and were not included in this packet. And thus, that is why we make the distinction in the audit report, only giving credit for the pieces that were submitted as attached to an individual vendor or campaign official. So,
did I overread then the general counsel, the state party's, the general counsel's affidavit and his statement that all of the mailings that the party engaged in were conducted pursuant to the volunteer mail exemption?
That is what he stated.
Yes.
However, we just made the distinction only because the committee did take the time to actually separate out the different vendor items, and the affidavits do clearly state that these invoices and mail pieces were supplied by the New York Republicans for their review, and they were, per their recollection, conducted under the volunteer materials exemption. So,
can I continue, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, but she's still talking.
Oh, okay.
I can take a question.
I guess, is there just a gap in their identification? I guess I'm not completely following the gap between what that affidavit covers and the more all-inclusive representation by the counsel for the Mr. David Provite?
Yes.
Where he says all of the express advocacy mailings reported as federal election activity on line 30B of the committee's FEC disclosure reports during the 2012 election cycle were part of the committee's volunteer mail program. And I followed the same procedures described in my February 2015 affidavit to ensure there was substantial volunteer participation in all of the mailings production and distribution. Are you telling me that there is a gap, there is a group of direct mail expenditures that is not covered by this statement in paragraph 8 of the affidavit? In other words, were there other mailings that were not reported as federal election activity on line 30B?
No, there were not.
So the gap is in the evidentiary submission?
Yes.
Okay. Now, how do we make the submission by the vendor speak to this representation? In other words, were all of the mailings done by this one vendor?
No, they were not. We received four vendor, some of them were repeats. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm trying to recall off the top of my head. Some were repeat affidavits, meaning that the committee, New York Republicans, went back to the vendor and supplied more invoices and mailers, and then the vendor submitted an additional affidavit. So we have received somewhere between 6 and 10 affidavits from vendors and campaign officials. And the only reason that there is a distinction made is because the Atlas, for example, the 95,000 was not included in the packet that we received from the actual vendor, and it still remained outstanding, and we just didn't make the leap because there were no affidavits attached to Mr. Previtt's. There were no invoices and mailers attached to Mr. Previtt's affidavit.
I have not read the vendor affidavits that you're referring to that attach mail pieces. Do they represent that these are mailings that were processed using volunteers?
Yes, they do.
Okay. And so, excuse me. So you credited those affidavits from the vendors?
Yes, we did.
Were the vendors responsible for operating the direct mail program for the party?
Yes, they were. They were not responsible, but they were the visitors.
They assisted?
Yes.
Okay. And they printed?
Yes, they did.
Okay. Production. Provided postage, that yes. type of thing, while volunteers processed it. At least that's the representation.
Yes, sir.
Years later, after an election cycle, what was the total universe of direct mail?
The total universe of direct mail was 1.1 million.
And you say what's unaccounted out of 1.1 million is about a little less than $100,000?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And they just, what you haven't found is the specific mailers that correlate to that $100,000. No one has submitted you an affidavit covering invoices for the last $100,000 of $1.1 million.
Yes, they were not attached to the affidavit. We do have the mailers and the invoices, but they were not attached to the affidavit.
And it's the absence of the mailers and invoices for that last $100,000, and therefore no specific vendor affidavit on which the audit staff has concluded or decided to recommend a finding that those were independent expenditures.
Yes, sir. And again, because some of that activity, that $91,000, does relate to Atlas Mail, which we did receive a packet for, and they were $85,000 of that $91,000. There's a small amount that was not. But $85,000 of that $91,000 was in support of two candidates, and they are the two candidates that we received affidavit from Atlas Direct Mail to support their volunteer component. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I'll yield to Commissioner Weintraub.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I don't seem to have the affidavits all in front of me, but my recollection is there were three different kinds of affidavits. There was the affidavit from the lawyer saying, I did my job as a lawyer. I understand the volunteer exception, and I explained it to them and told them that they had to have volunteers. And I agree with what I think your determination is that that's great that they have a good lawyer who explained the law to them, but he wasn't physically there when the mailers were being produced, and he can't really testify from personal knowledge as to whether there were any volunteers present at each and every one of the productions of these mailers, right?
Correct.
Then there are a number of vendor affidavits that said, you know, we actually produced the mailers, and there were volunteers present at the production of these specific mailers, and they attached them. And there was one, I think, that was said he had a subcontractor, if I'm recalling correctly. So there was the lawyer, and then there was the general contractor, and then there was a subcontractor who actually prepared the mailing. And on that one, we only have an affidavit from the general contractor, not from the subcontractor. So again, I think we have, and you and I may differ on what conclusion to draw from this, but I think we have, from my perspective, an evidentiary problem there, again, because the person who submitted the affidavit was a step removed from the actual production and from being in the room with the volunteers. Am I right about that?
I would have to get back to you on that last group. I know that we had the vendor, the campaign officials. I know there was one from a campaign manager. And Mr. Previtt, the counsel, I would have to look into the one that you're speaking of now.
Okay. Because my own conclusion would be that, you know, I'm willing to accept the affidavits from the guys who were in the room where it happened, so to speak, or, you know, were, like, really close to the production of it and say that they had volunteers there. But it's harder for me to accept as an evidentiary matter an affidavit from someone who wasn't there, even, you know, because the best they can do is say, we understood the law, we explained it to the people who are actually producing the mailers, but they can't, because they weren't there, testify from personal knowledge as to whether there were volunteers there or not.
Commissioner Goodman.
Yeah, I understand the point. I read the affidavit from the lawyer a little differently, and it could be there's some some interpretation of the affidavit, but I'm reading from the affidavit, and he not only says he was responsible for the legal compliance, but he goes on to say, my affidavit dated February 6, 2015, previously submitted to the commission, describes specific examples of how I coordinated volunteer participation, staffing activities, and ensured that volunteers participated directly in the sorting, bundling, bagging, and tagging of mail pieces by local zip codes and in the loading of mail bags onto trucks for delivery to U.S. post offices. It was also standard practice to have extra copies of the mail pieces printed for hand distribution by volunteers. And he claims I followed the same procedures described in my February 2015 affidavit to ensure there was substantial volunteer participation in all of the mailings production. Now, in the past, we have seen not nearly the detailed affidavits we have here from the actual vendors. And I don't know about you, but I know that we had some votes on the commission.
Yes,
that at least
not mine.
Maybe not yours. But where what the party comes in with 3 or 4 years hence, you know, after an election cycle, is they come in with the sign-in sheets for maybe 5 of 15 volunteer mail sessions and pictures of 4 others, and it's a patchwork quilt of documentation that they have, but they show that they did try to comply with the volunteer mail exemption. And then they follow up with an affidavit in the absence of any evidence about the other 10 events, the other 10 nights where volunteers came down to party headquarters and put the stamps on and sorted the mail. They have an affidavit that says the only kind of mail program that the party operated in this election cycle was volunteer mail. We didn't do other kinds of mail. And all of our mail programs, that is the other 10 for which we have no evidence, all of them operated in the same way that the 5 we have documentation for operated. And that's the way I read this affidavit is, here we've got more evidence than we've even seen in some of those cases as to about $1 million worth of mail from the vendors. The only gap in evidence is $100,000 worth of the mail. But then we have the, I'll call it sort of the omnibus or the cleanup affidavit that says, I coordinated operations in all of our direct mail conformed to this practice. Now, you know, it's almost as if to say, I'm sorry, there's 10% of it for which I can't recreate every direct mail piece and every volunteer night and pizza night at the party headquarters, but I'm telling you, all of our mail program was run in conformance with the evidence that we've submitted here. And I think it's a reasonable inference that if you can show that for $1 million of $1.1 million, that the last $100,000 probably fell within the... It would be very odd to run $1 million of mail through a volunteer program and then have this one little piece out there that was not done in a volunteer way, especially given an affidavit that says all of it was done that way.
Mr. Chairman?
Pardon me, Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you. I'm not sure. I agree with you that it would be very odd because, excuse me, the nature of volunteer activity. Excuse me. Sorry, something caught my throat. The nature of volunteer activity is it depends on the volunteers showing up, and it strikes me as not at all inconceivable that, you know, you put your calls out and you make your best efforts to get your volunteers to show up, and, you know, one day you get 5 volunteers and another day you get 4 volunteers and one day you get no volunteers. Now, do they shut down their operation if the no volunteers show up, or do they say, oh, okay, well, we were all set up to print these things out and get them out, so we're going to do that because we've got an election coming up and we want to get the mail out, which is... And I am not, I could be wrong about this, but I am not aware of me personally having voted for accepting, okay, you know, we have affidavits or we have documentation for 40%, and therefore, you know, you should assume that we had the same kind of system in place for all of them. I have in front of me, by the way, right now, the affidavit that I was remembering, which comes from Dan Hazelwood, who said he is the president of Targeted Creative Communications, and he subcontracted the printing and addressing of these materials to Phoenix Graphics of Rochester, New York. And then goes on to describe how he instructed Phoenix Graphics what they were supposed to do. But again, he's the general. There was a subcontractor. He can't, it's, you know, I'm not saying that what he's saying here isn't true. I'm sure it is. It's just that he did not, by definition, have personal knowledge of, you know, whether the volunteers showed up.
Just real quick to ask you a question. And looking at the one affidavit by Dan Hazelwood, it does say that, and I apologize for not being more current on this, but it says specifically they were instructed to have volunteers sort the materials as they were completed by the printer addressing facility by bundling, bagging, and tagging the pieces and then placing them on a delivery truck. The mail would not be accepted by the USPS if it were not for the key volunteer components. It sounds to me like this was the instructions that were given, but there's nobody there to verify that it happened and was them. Or is that your view that enough has been done to assume that that's been done?
Yes, and I'm looking at the affidavit of David Previte, who apparently submitted two affidavits and says that he was responsible and did coordinate the volunteer staffing activities. And he makes a representation that I have accepted in a prior audit that all of this committee's mail program was done as a volunteer mail program. We have a different gap in evidence in this case, though, than we've had in others. In others, the gap of evidence is the sign-in sheets and the photos of the volunteer night and the pizza boxes that pile up. And we have allowed the affidavit to fill that void, at least some commissioners have. Here, the party has gone far beyond that, and they have tried to actually attach each and every mail piece that was printed by a vendor and have the vendor explain, here are all the mail pieces I printed, and I worked with the party's volunteers to effectively mail those. And the gap now is because we created all this additional affidavit evidence, the gap is that some vendors didn't account for about $90,000 of the mailings, but we still have the gap filler of the catch-all affidavit that all of our mail program was done in this way. We only ran a volunteer mail program. I understand that there, in some cases, maybe somebody didn't show up, but it gets to be, am I going to credit the party's representation that that's the only kind of mail program that they ran, and that all of their mail was done by the volunteer mail procedure. And so I've credited it in the past with far less gap-filling affidavits than we have here. Here they went the extra mile and actually got the vendors to provide the evidence as to $1 million worth of $1.1 million. And it has been, it is certainly possible that on one night nobody came to stuff the envelopes and the mail house went ahead and mailed them out, you know, itself. But I think it's just as plausible that that's the they only ran these as volunteer programs because that was the program in place at the party. And the fact that the gap now is down to $100,000 out of $1.1 million makes that even more plausible to me, in my mind.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure none of this is making any sense at all to our Moldovan visitors. But just to give a little bit of background, because it does affect how I view these, you know, the reason that we care about this at all is because there's an exemption to what would otherwise be a contribution limit from the party to these candidates. There's an exemption for if they prepare these materials, it won't count against their cat. What?
No, these would have been independent. The finding is that they were independent expenditures, and parties under Colorado can make independent expenditures.
Well, they said they weren't independent, though. They should know.
Oh,
whether
okay.
They were.
Yes, I'm right.
If they told us they weren't independent, then they should know whether they were working with the candidates or not. I'm certainly willing to credit that if they say they you know that. I mean, that would be a different argument if they came in and said that they were done independently. That's not what they're arguing. They're saying they were not done independently of the candidate, but they shouldn't be counted against the limit on how much they can spend on behalf of their candidates because these communications were prepared with the substantial assistance of volunteers. And there's a specific exemption for that to encourage volunteer activity. But what we have... there's two problems with that. One is that exemption specifically says that it's not supposed to cover direct mail, and the commission has bent over backwards to basically say that direct mail isn't really direct mail, even though direct mail is otherwise defined as a mail that's done at a commercial mailing house. The commission has said, well, even if it's done at a commercial mailing house, if you've got some volunteers in there doing something along the way, that'll still be good enough. We'll just pretend that it's not at a commercial mailing house, and I have a bit of a problem with that from the get-go. But what I think is happening in a lot of instances is because it no longer nobody stuffs envelopes anymore out there in the real world. Everybody uses commercial mailers, and they come up with things for the volunteers to do in order to take advantage of this exemption. But the bulk of the work is being handled by the professionals, by the commercial mail house, and I think in many instances they kind of bring in the volunteers to, you know, we've had discussions about this where Commissioner Peterson has talked about the blessing of the mail by the volunteers. You get a few volunteers in the room, take their picture, feed them some pizza, and they, you know, move the bags from one side of the room to the other or load them on the truck, and we say, okay, now it's a volunteer activity. It's all gotten, I think, very far away from the original notion of what the volunteer participation would be and how important it would be to the production of the mail. So since I'm somewhat skeptical that this exemption really even applies anymore, that makes me even more convinced that I need to see some solid evidence that the volunteers were really in the room and were playing some role in this. I don't doubt for a second that this lawyer tried to ensure and took whatever steps he could to ensure that it was all running according to his understanding of the law. I'm not suggesting that he wasn't doing his job, but he also wasn't in the room.
Any further comment? I find it, this is a close one for me because I also have some of the skepticism of Commissioner Weintraub, but I also see an attempt in good faith to try recognize their responsibility and do it for the most part. And so I wasn't really sure. But I also share the concern of Commissioner Weintraub that an overreaching affidavit that scoops up things that clearly there's no personal knowledge about are risky to accept without saying, well, we did it once and we're going to do it again. So I'm finding this a tough one. So the peers at 90%, close to 90%, got over the hurdle, but this 10% did not. So I'm still thinking it over. Yes, Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want
to. It's nice to be able to call you Commissioner Peterson while we can.
Thank you. I just want to shift gears slightly to funding one.
What's that? I didn't hear it.
Finding one, the misrepresentation, a financial activity finding. And it appears that the bulk of the issue here is the, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I understood it is that the committee represents that it received both federal and non-federal contributions into its federal account, and then from that point would use it as a merchant account, and then would then send contributions that either because of their amount or because of the source or some other indicia would then be transferred to the non-federal account.
That's correct.
Okay. And in 2011, that amount constituted $190,000. So we had $190,000 that came in to the federal account that was determined to be actually for the non-federal account and then was subsequently transferred. And then 2012, we had a similar arrangement set up, and the amount at issue was $157,447, is the way I understand it.
Yes.
So the committee argued that, and cited to a 2001 advisory opinion, I believe it's the DNC Services opinion, to argue by analogy that in essence, this was. These deposits were out of administrative convenience, and that none of these funds were, none of these non-federal funds were actually used for federal purposes. And is there any evidence to indicate that non-federal funds were actually used for federal purposes, or does that is that representation borne out by what you found?
Not really. No, there was no non-federal funds used for federal accounts.
Okay. So it sounds like it happened the way they represented, where all of it would come into their federal account, and then they would dispense to their non-federal as appropriate.
That's true.
But it was the audit division's conclusion, and I guess supported by OGC, that the 2001 AO, 2001-17 to be precise, was not applicable in this case. And I don't know if I... Do I turn to Mr. Bloom to speak to that issue? They recognize that it wasn't on all that they're arguing by analogy, but it was the office's determination that this isn't applicable in this instance. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of flesh out that conclusion that OGC arrived at in this particular matter.
Yes. Thank you, Commissioner Peterson. We had concluded in our comments that Advisory Opinion 2001-17, that had pertained to a national committee at the time that had made an inquiry about how it should handle contributions that were intended to be split between the federal and non-federal accounts. And the Commission authorized a process by which the National Committee could take so-called, we refer to it in our comments as composite mm-hmm. contributions, and deposit the entire amount, even though part of it was intended to be non-federal, into the federal account and subsequently transfer the non-federal portion to a non-federal account so long as the transactions were properly disclosed in the reports. So there were two aspects to our analysis in this case. There was the substantive aspect of the analysis, which concerned whether 11 CFR 102.5, which normally prohibits the introduction of non-federal funds into federal accounts, whether that applies here. And then the second aspect would be the procedural aspect in terms of the reporting, whether the transactions were properly disclosed. My understanding in terms of the reporting aspect from the audit division was that none of these actual transfers, the deposits of the non-federal credit card contributions and the transfer to the non-federal account were actually reported in any way or disclosed in the federal report. merits. And it's my understanding that the committee's argument was that it wasn't required to do that. So in that sense, we didn't think that Advisory Opinion 2001-17 would cover the committee's non-reporting of the deposit and subsequent transfer. In terms of the substantive issue, the opinion itself was confined to the composite contribution situation, as I understood it, as we understood it, and it wasn't clear. And I don't know if the audit division, I don't believe the audit division actually has information about this, whether the contributions in question in this case, the credit card contributions, were actually composite contributions, or whether they were intended wholly to be non-federal contributions. That we considered significant because actually the parameters of the 2001-17 opinion included a representation by the National Committee in that opinion that any wholly non-federal contributions that it received, it would deposit directly into its non-federal account rather than use the federal account as a conduit for the transfer. So it seemed to be factually significant to us to identify what portion of the contributions in this case were composite contributions and what portion were wholly non-federal contributions. Composite contributions for the substantive question about the violation of Section 102.5, that would be permissible under the parameters of the Advisory Opinion 2001-17. But wholly non-federal contributions, our view was and remains that they ought to have been deposited directly into the non-federal account.
Okay. I appreciate that explanation. Oh,
Mr. Goodman. Excuse me.
Joshua, Mr. Bloom, the deposit. Is the finding here a reporting that they didn't report these dollars, or is there also a finding, or alternatively, either in addition to a finding of depositing state funds into a proper account while the regulations require there to be two different accounts? In other words, what's the finding, that they just simply didn't report these receipts into the federal account?
Well, as I understand the way that the audit report currently reads, mm-hmm. The finding is one of reporting.
Reporting, yes.
It's reporting.
Yes. But it was our office, actually, that raised the potential substantive issue as also a potential issue, and we had suggested that might be a part of the finding.
And it is or is not a part of the finding. A more substantive violation of the deposit of the funds versus a reporting violation.
Just reporting.
Yeah. And as to the reporting, the party has invoked the older opinion that merely using the federal account taking a check with some of the funds intended for the state account and moving them out, the money was never intended to be accounted for by the federal committee, although the account was used to receive and then disperse the funds.
Yes.
So it's a use of a bank account, but their position is, because they didn't, their position is because they never intended to realize the state portion of that contribution, they didn't report it as a federal contribution because they moved the money promptly to the state account.
Yes, I believe that is a synopsis of their position. They essentially said that they reported all of these non-federal contributions in their state reports, and that sufficed.
So it was an accounting. It's as much an accounting issue. So then it seems to me that the broader issue is hold aside the reporting, whether they should have realized these receipts and reported them on their federal reports. It strikes me that could be viewed more as a misuse of the federal account rather than a reporting issue.
Yes, I suppose it could be seen that way. That's not how I had originally conceptualized it. I had also, in terms of the reporting question, there was language in 2000 in the advisory opinion, the older advisory opinion 2001-17, in which the commission strongly emphasizes that if the national committee is going to use the federal account this way to deposit mixed contributions and transfer the non-federal portion, it has to be very clearly noted in the federal reports.
As memo entries or how?
It could be noted as memo entries. We had advice from RAD that it wouldn't necessarily have to be noted as a federal receipt per se. That is the reports analysis division had provided us with information indicating that it could be noted as memo entries.
In other words, not realized in the cash on hand balances,
right. Exactly.
But merely the money in, money out. Could have, if they had just made a memo entry.
Yes.
Okay. And is that written somewhere? Is there a policy written about the memo entry, or was that sort of RAD's advice internally in the building to the Office of General Counsel in connection with this audit?
That was RAD's advice to us.
Yes.
There was also a prior matter that I had looked at, an audit of the Missouri State Democratic Committee, where it looked like memo entries would have been acceptable in that case.
Okay.
So I checked with.
I'm sorry, Josh.
I checked with RAD to see what reporting method would be acceptable, and RAD indicated to me at the time that either way would be acceptable.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Commissioner Goodman.
Question for the audit division. When we audited this committee, did we ever advise them that if they filed either a Form 99 amendment or amended their reports to reflect this as a memo entry, that would be a proper cure or a proper remedy to the reporting problem?
No, we did not.
Okay.
So my concern to this is, a little aside from what's happened, is if there's not, to just treat it as there's no cash on hand, I get that, but it seems to me you might have a situation where you've got, say, $1 million flowing through of non-federal money and $100,000 of federal money, and somewhere there should be some disclosure of the time when that non-federal money was held by the federal account as kind of a custodian, which is a concerning situation. To have that much money, this is by analogy, but still, it seems to be there should be some policy that recognizes that and points it out to somebody who might be looking at a report. I just wonder if we should have. It seems to me there must have been a lot of times when this has happened in the past, and it just has been dealt with ad hoc. Any further questions on where to go with this? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And from what I understand from the report, this issue has been resolved going forward. I believe that the New York Republican Party has made representations that this is no longer the method by which they take in contributions. They figured out ways to code the credit card contributions in order to have them dispersed immediately to the proper accounts, and that this is no longer the method by which they receive credit card contributions. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So it sounds like the issue's been resolved to a large extent. This is, activity that took place back in 2011, 2012. So obviously, it's quite a ways in our rearview mirror. I think that, and Mr. Bloom, thank you for the explanation and kind of the extent of the reasoning that you had to reach this conclusion. I don't necessarily disagree with it. I think you're probably right on it. I think though that I'm going to probably vote to put the amounts or pertaining to the credit card contributions to have that put into additional issues. I'm not sure that I feel completely comfortable saying that the advisory opinion or some analogous argument that could be that could be derived from that opinion is necessarily incorrect. I think in a matter like this, again, that is somewhat older. I'm not sure that I want to necessarily bite down on that in this particular case, and so I think that. But also because of the length of time that has transpired, I also don't want to drag this out needlessly as well. I think that in the representations from counsel, I think some finality is requested with respect to this audit. So when it comes time to make motions on that, I'm going to support moving at least the analysis that pertains to the credit card contributions to the additional issues section.
Okay. Thank you. Anything further? Commissioner Goodman.
I see that our Moldovan visitors have departed. But for the good of the order, I didn't want to leave something out there hanging. I do believe the consequence, if you do not accept the affidavits here, is an IE, not a coordinated expenditure. I believe the representation of coordinated expenditures was the Hawaii Democratic Party audit that comes after this. I'm looking at the finding. The finding is failure to file independent expenditure reports. I don't think there was a representation here that the mail pieces were coordinated. Am I right about that? This is an independent expenditure reporting issue?
Yes, it is.
And it's the Hawaii Democratic Party audit that comes later where the council made the representation that the mail pieces were coordinated? Yes. So this is not a party coordinated expenditure limit case. The consequence, if we don't accept the affidavit, is that they didn't file IE reports timely for 24, 48-hour IE reports.
Commissioner Peterson. Excuse me, Commissioner Weintraub. No offense.
But somebody help me out with this. Isn't the whole point of using volunteers, the whole point of the volunteer material exemption is an exemption to the coordinated spending, isn't it?
It may have that beneficial effect, but it also avoids treating them as independent expenditures and the 24, 48-hour reporting of independent expenditures. Am I wrong? I mean, it may have a couple effects.
Well, the volunteer mails exemption is an exemption generally to the definition of expenditure.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay. All right.
So, and there was no evidence, I take it, in our audit that there was coordination.
No, there was not.
And so the finding here would be that they made independent expenditures that they didn't timely report in 24, 48-hour reports.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you. I just had one final clarification, and this pertains to finding three. So this was the occupation, name of employer. I just want to make sure that I understand. There are a lot of different slicing of that 205 number, and I just want to make sure that I fully understand it. So there were 205 itemized individuals contributing a total of $563,000 and change, and it was the audit division's conclusion that 95 of those did not have that there weren't best efforts demonstrated, but the committee had demonstrated, or at least had the documentation to demonstrate best efforts with respect to 110?
No, 348.
Yes.
Okay. And, but, oh, yeah,
on
Ms.
the 110, and testify, you can correct me wrong, on the 110 and contributions, they had the information, but they didn't file amendments.
Yes.
So those.
But, okay,
those
so of that subset of 110, they had the documentation, but filed amendments with respect to what, 91 of them?
No.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So So there were, I guess, another 19 that they could have, that they had the documentation for, but amendments weren't filed.
Yeah, the amendments weren't filed as of the time of the audit, and so that's what they why those amounts were in the original violation amount. Post the audit, they filed amendments for 91 of them. Is that correct?
Correct. They filed amendments for 91.
For 91.
Yes.
And is that current as of right now? Do we know if any further amendments with respect to the other 19 have been filed, or is it just as far as we know, 91 is just the number?
As far as we know.
Okay. Okay. So when I first read the summary of the finding in the last sentence, it said in response to the interim audit report recommendation, NYR included memo entries in its most recently filed disclosure report providing the missing contributor information. I'm assuming, does that mean with respect to the 91?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So if that's indeed the case, we may just want to make that clarification in the report just to ensure that someone who only skips to the highlights and doesn't get into the meat of these reports will fully understand what the nature of the finding is. But that's the only question I had with respect to occupation and employer. Thank you.
Any questions? Further discussion? Any motions?
One minute, Mr. Chairman.
Of course. Mr. Peterson,
I'll make a suggestion as to how we may want to proceed. That hopefully can bring this to a close. I think that there, as far as I know, there's probably agreement on findings 2, 3, and 5. I don't have any disagreements with the auditor's findings on that, other than maybe that we want to make a note on the summary of finding 3, just to make it crystal clear what the nature of the finding was. We could make that motion first, and then we could maybe make separate motions with respect to findings 1 and 4. And then I think at some point we can find some satisfaction on all sides and put this one to bed. So, but I'd be happy with respect to findings 2, 3, and 5 in the that we approve the audit division recommendation memorandum on the New York Republican Federal Campaign Committee, which is audit 13-11, that we approve those findings.
Commissioner Goodman, on the for the audit staff in the record keeping for employees, the proposed finding of failure to maintain monthly payroll logs totaling $713,427, was any portion of that funded by the state party wholly from state funds? Were any employees in that paid wholly from state funds?
No.
Okay, thank you.
All in favor of that motion?
Aye.
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 Opposed? And the ayes have it unanimously. Commissioner Weintraub?
I'll take them one at a time. The second one's going to be a little bit tricky. With respect to the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the New York Republican Federal Campaign Committee, A13-11, as set forth in agenda document number 17-55A, I move approval of finding 1.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Okay. The motion fails. Commissioner Weintraub and I voted in favor, and voting against was the Vice Chair, Commissioner Goodman, and Commissioner Peterson. Excuse me, Commissioner Peterson.
also make a motion with respect to finding one. I move that we approve the finding of the audit division, except that with respect to the amounts that relate to the credit card contributions received by the committee, which were, I think it was $190,000 in 2011 and $157,447, that portion of the finding be kicked to additional issues.
About the $91,000?
About the 190 in 11 and the 150, was it 157? Those portions of the finding, I recommend that those be put in the additional issues section.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. I'm in favor. Passed unanimously. Retreating motions. Commissioner Weintraub.
Okay. With respect to finding 4, reporting of apparent independent expenditures.
Can
you tell me the number that you have? It's a little bit hard to find in here.
The number that we have is $1,051,064 for we have $1,051,064 in apparent independent expenditures due to the lack of a clear standard. And we ask that the commission find that NYR failed to report mailers containing express advocacy totaling $91,439. And I'm sorry.
Thank you. With respect to finding 4, I move approval of the recommendation with the numbers stated by Ms. Burgess, except that I would like to add in, and it's not going to pass, so you know, at some point somebody can do the math, I suppose, but it's almost an academic question. I would add to the 91 the amount that would have been covered by the Hazelwood affidavit. Do you understand what I'm saying?
You would like to add to the 91,000 the amount that was covered by the targeted creative?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because we have an affidavit from the general contractor, but not from the sub-vendor who was actually doing the work and could have spoken with personal knowledge as to whether the volunteers were in the room.
Madam Vice Chair.
Sorry, could you please clarify, are you now not crediting the Hazelwood affidavit? I'm not following what you're...
Well, I'm not... I believe that this, you know, I'm not saying he's lying, but as I indicated before, he did not have personal knowledge of the production because he was he subcontracted the printing and the addressing to Phoenix Graphics, and he told them what to do, but he wasn't there when they did it, so he cannot from personal knowledge testify as to whether there were volunteers in the room because he and his people were not in the room. It went to a subcontractor.
And is that subcontractor, I just don't remember the name right now, the same subcontractor that we got the other information from?
No, he is not. That he is one vendor, and he supplied only one affidavit for just that small.
So we don't have anything from Phoenix Graphics who actually did the work.
So you're adding to the 91,000?
Yes. The amount that would have been covered by this particular affidavit that was produced by Targeted Creative Communications through their subcontract to Phoenix Graphics. I don't have those numbers, but I would direct audit to do the math for me.
You know, I think that just reminds me that, you know, it's obvious we've talked about this a million times, but there, and it even is in what we said a minute ago, there's a lack of a clear standard for this volunteer exemption. And now I'm even more confused, and I'm sure the public is too, and the Moldovans even left. But I will reiterate my interest in trying to get a fourth vote for the policy that we put out a few years ago and then put out again a couple of months ago. Happy to take comments, and I intend to put that back on a public meeting agenda in the near future. I think we're just making it more and more confusing for the public who's trying to take advantage of utilizing volunteers in our public process and our political process.
A question on the 91,000 on the affidavit, was that credited for other funds except for the 91,000?
There are no affidavits for the 91,000.
Well, there's an affidavit saying no personal knowledge.
No.
Okay. But I'm missing out on that.
The targeted, Mr. Hazelwood's affidavit is worth approximately $35,000.
I see.
That is not included in the 91,000 figure.
So my motion would make a finding of failure to report apparent independent expenditures.
Would be the 91,000 plus the 35,000.
Yes, the 91 plus the 35. That would cover the 91 plus the 35.
I'm still wavering a little bit. I'll support Commissioner Weintraub, but I think that's really a close one for me. We do need some clarification on how we're going to treat affidavits and other things, too.
I need to call the vote, Mr. Chairman.
So, yeah, I guess we did. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. The motion fails. Commissioner Weintraub and I both voted. There was a nay vote, and the commissioner, the vice chair, Commissioner Peterson, and Commissioner Goodman.
We voted.
Voted in favor.
Yes.
What did they say?
You got it backwards.
We
voted aye. They voted nay.
We voted aye, but it was unsuccessful for those votes. That's what I meant to say.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If I could make an inquiry of either the audit staff or Office of General Counsel, would it be, I wasn't planning on supporting any portion of finding four since we voted against it. Is there any need to make an affirmative motion to request that this be put in additional issues, or is just the 2-3 vote sufficient at this point to have that be put into additional issues?
I think it needs to have to say.
So I think at this point it'd be clear to vote on finding four. There's two issues in finding four to vote on. There's the 91,000, which are the mailer cost that were excluded from any vendor affidavit or campaign affidavit. And those are costs that I think some commissioners say are covered by the generic affidavit. Just to be clear, those are excluded because we separated those because those were purposely excluded by the vendor. When the vendor listed out what mailers they were discussing in their affidavits that covered BME, they did not include those invoices, which were from their company. And so because those weren't included in their listing of what had volunteer involvement, we excluded those. Even though I understand that some of the commission feels that the generic affidavit covers those. So that's the 91,000, as well as the audit division is asking that the commission vote on what is the new number?
$1,051,064.
And that number represents affidavits covered by vendors that associated with direct mailers. It includes the one also that Commissioner Weintraub wanted to exclude. So you still need a vote on that finding on those two issues.
What?
The 91,000 as well as a
million something. How is that different from the motion I just made?
The 91,000, you voted on part of the finding.
No, I included the million in my motion.
Oh.
I didn't hear that. Am I wrong, Madam Secretary?
Mr. Calvert.
I think that wasn't quite what I had tried to
see what happens.
Import.
It's a telephone game.
Commissioner Weintraub's motion regarding finding four did contain
an amendment to do something different than the audit division recommended. You haven't voted yet up or down one way or the other on their recommendation on finding four. I don't think you have to, but the record would be cleaner if you did.
Well, I'm not sure that, I mean, I amended it because, I mean, all due respect, I don't think anybody agrees with the actual recommendation.
Right.
So there was an amended motion. I'm not sure what you accomplished by getting an up or down vote on your recommendation. I don't really see what that adds.
It's up to the commission. It's without being intimately familiar with the finding, I saw an amendment, and that was not what the audit division had recommended. If your point, as I understand it, is that you were in favor of everything, your motion encompassed everything the audit division recommended,
and then some.
You don't have to.
So, at this point, with the 2-3 vote on Commissioner Weintraub, it would go to additional issues. So
yeah.
We don't need to have a further motion,
right.
And we can. All right, and we can put this one to bed. Okay.
That's kind of what I was saying.
All right.
Just come out
that was the phraseology you were looking for.
So we're good. We're done.
Yep.
So that concludes this discussion, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Going to this one.
Yeah, I think they're waiting for something.
Oh. Let's see. We're going to skip 3 and 4, but we'll continue now with 2. Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Hawaii Democratic Party, HDP A13-07.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum for the Hawaii Democratic Party. The report presents 7 findings. Misstatement of financial activity, receipt of contribution that exceeds limits, receipt of apparent impermissible refunds, reporting of debts and obligations, record keeping for employees, and failure to properly report media related expenditures and allocation of expenditures. Thank you. We're available to answer your questions.
Thank you. Comment? Commissioner Weintraub.
Just a couple of questions. I just want to make sure. I think I know the answers to this, but I just want to make sure. So there was some back and forth with the committee over the convention account. And I take it that now everyone is satisfied that that was purely a state convention account? Is that
correct?
Is that right?
Correct.
And we have sufficient documentation of that? We're all comfortable with that conclusion?
Yes.
Okay, good. The other question that I had goes to the finding 6. The coordination issue. So I just want to confirm that this is on all fours with what happened in the audit of the Democratic Executive Committee of Florida. So the in this one, in the Hawaii audit, they spent more than they were authorized to spend on behalf of the Senate candidate, but they did not, there was the combined spending of the state party and the national party did not exceed the combined spending limit. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. In that case, I'm happy to approve the report. I just wanted to make sure I had my facts straight.
I'm sorry, could you
give
that again? What was the finding of the Democratic Executive Committee of Florida? What was the upshot of that matter?
Essentially, just and both situations are very similar with Hawaii and Florida. Mm-hmm. Just the committee had their spending limit, and the DSCC or whatever the other committee was had their spending limit. Hawaii exceeded their spending limit mm-hmm. and only received maybe, I forget what it was, $5,000 from the DSSC.
DSCC, yes.
DSCC, okay. And just in response, the council is saying, provided a letter from the DSCC saying that had we known they wanted more of the authority, we would have given the rest of our authority to them. You know, but that was after they had already made the expenditures.
Right.
And just so we presented it in this report, because these are the facts of Florida, where they made the coordinated expenditures prior to receiving the authorization or the spending authority, the additional spending
authority. And what was the commission's result in the Florida case?
The commission's result was they accepted that and acknowledged that the overall limit wasn't exceeded, and there was no issue of requesting a refund from the county.
Sort of no harm, no foul? I mean, in other words, as long as you didn't exceed the combined limit?
Well, I think...
I'm sorry.
I just thought this might be helpful. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we made a finding,
yes.
but we did not require a refund.
Yes.
And that is the same result that's being recommended here.
I see. So finding, but no refund.
Right. Because they didn't get their paperwork in advance of the spending, which they should have done. But mm-hmm. had they done that, there wouldn't have been any excessive spending.
Do you know if there was ever a penalty assessed in that, against the Democratic Executive Committee of Florida following up that audit finding?
No idea.
Unaware or no?
Unaware.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand, Pat.
Unaware, sir.
Unaware. Okay. I might want to just check on that to see what the consequence is. Did you have other questions?
No.
Mr. Chairman, I had a couple questions.
Go right ahead.
In finding 4 on debts and obligations, the total amount was $115,000. Did the audit staff use the date of invoice as the trigger date for reporting a debt outstanding? In other words, did you go get invoices and say...
We would primarily look at the invoice date or the date of incurrence, but then also look at the invoice to see whether it was, you know, a 30-day, you know, pay within 30 days. You know, for many of the cases and on these vendors, just the payments were months later.
Months later. Okay. So, well, let me ask what the audit staff's date of reporting is. Is it the invoice date or the due date?
Traditionally, just I go with the invoice date.
Invoice date. But you're saying that wasn't consequential here because the whole $115,000 was not even paid within 30 days?
Correct.
Okay. So whether you use trigger date, whether you use some kind of due date, they tripped that wire.
Correct.
Okay. That's may I continue, Mr. Chair?
Continue. For sure.
Finding number 5. There is a finding that employees to the tune of $12,413 were paid exclusively with non-federal funds.
Yes.
Do you know what employees those were?
Not right offhand.
For example, was it a receptionist? I used to work for State Party, and we had a janitor. You know. A regular employee of the committee who took care of the building. Okay. Do you know the nature of the $12,413?
Not right up.
Did you have any evidence that the people who were paid exclusively for non-federal funds engaged in federal election activity?
Yes, just because we could see that those federal employees, I can't say specifically that they were also on the federal reports, you know, as receiving a payroll, but just by the description, I could say that they were engaged in some sort of federal portion of federal activity.
Is that in the file that I'll find on the computer, or do I need to follow up with you to get that granular level of information?
Yes, that's not on
the... I'll follow up with you on that. Mr. Chairman, I may not be prepared to vote today, but I do want to work through these issues.
Yeah, you go right ahead.
So can I just add in? So this is a finding on record keeping on whether they kept a record of the monthly log.
Right.
And they didn't satisfy that record of a monthly log.
Right.
It's not whether or not what their role was.
Yes.
And so it's been broken in down into...
Yeah, I think there's been some disagreement on the commission about whether a log is required under the technical language of the regulation for those who are paid exclusively with non-federal funds, mm-hmm. and where there is no indication that they actually engaged in federal election activity. And that's why I'm... By the way, the 12,413 is not remarkable, but the legal principle can be. So that's why I'm inquiring about it.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, let's see. Turning in the report. Did the committee here submit any affidavits about the work of the employees
for
whom logs were not kept?
Mm-hmm.
No affidavits?
No.
Were they represented by counsel during the audit?
Yes.
Okay. Turning to page,
and I just want to, I don't know if Audit Division isn't arguing that these people are federal employees. They're saying there wasn't a log to document that they did not have any federal activity.
I understand the issue. Yes, ma'am. I was a little confused on page 13. About the balance of $104,451.
This is for which finding?
This is finding 3, page 13.
That's the default.
You see, leaving an impermissible balance of $104,451. What was that? Was that a balance of $104,451 that was intended for the convention account that wasn't transferred, and that the federal account retained it? Or was that some? I guess I'm just trying to sort what that the significance of that $104,451.
Doug Kodish, I was on manager on this job. On page 18, there's a schedule that delineates what's in that. We excluded the convention account receipts of $22,006.
Yes.
The rest of this would have been other impermissible receipts.
Are the other impermissible receipts, were they represented to be receipts from of the federal account intended for the convention account that simply were not later transferred to the convention account? Oh, these are just ordinary improper contributions. Oh, there was no relationship to the convention account for the 104.
Just like we're backing out any impermissible receipts that went into the convention
account. You've given them credit for the convention account,
yes.
And you say we still have 104 for it.
If you look at the chart on 18, that's where we're backing out the 22,000 right.
Thank you. Thank you. I now understand that.
Now we're dealing with federal accounts.
Okay. On page 25 of the report, and I'm looking at little 2 down at the bottom of the page, for an apparent independent expenditure totaling $11,922. And it says that the they ran one, is that a, was that a radio ad, television ad, that said, Linda Lingle was wrong then about a lot of things, and she's wrong for Hawaii now. The audit staff believes the phrase "she's wrong for Hawaii" was express advocacy because it had the same meaning as defeat, and therefore could have no other meaning than to urge the defeat of the candidate. And so I take it the finding as to that 11,922 is that was a either independent expenditure or coordinated expenditure.
Actually, just all of these that we were calling independent now mm-hmm. are all coordinated.
Because of the representation of counsel.
Right.
So you're treating that as a coordinated?
Yes.
Okay.
This is in the preliminary audit report stage, and if you go over to page 26, it's all shifting to coordinated.
Okay.
And expressing the excess limit issue.
I see. So now my question is, in the legal conclusion that wrong for Hawaii constitutes express advocacy, did audit staff receive legal advice on that question?
That I don't recall.
You were asking, just to make sure I understand the question, you were asking if...
I'm asking who made that call. Was it audit or was it audit in consultation with OGC? Often there's a memorandum that that Lorenzo sends over when audit asks these questions.
In the there was a memorandum that discussed this. Yes,
there was.
Yes.
Did that memorandum? Did that memorandum distinguish the Office of General Counsel's memorandum in a advice it gave to the Alternative Dispute Resolution Office in a case called America's Liberty Pact, where an ad said Claire McCaskill wrong on the issues, wrong for Missouri?
I apologize. Commissioner Weintraub.
If I may, I believe every single ADR agreement says in its terms explicitly that it's not precedential. So I'm not sure why OGC would rely on an ADR agreement as precedent.
I'm just asking if OGC considered its advice in that case.
Okay. No, there's no reference.
Mr. Chairman, I might want to... and delve into this a little bit more outside this context. There was a case that this commission dismissed where a group called America's Liberty Pact, and I was actually recused from the case, but I can where the advice of general counsel to the Alternative Dispute Resolution Office was that an ad with the tagline Claire McCaskill wrong on the issues or something to that effect, wrong for Missouri, was not express advocacy. And the case was dismissed. It did not go to a final settlement agreement. And I think that's a close call there. And I think I want to delve into that issue a little bit more about whether that constitutes express advocacy. Again, the finding of 11,922 is not remarkable in itself, but the legal principle here about what constitutes express advocacy is an important issue.
Can I just ask if you have handy, Commissioner Goodman, the specific reference that you were, what you were referring to, which AD?
No, but there's a memo, Lorenzo. You,
the
case was America's Liberty Pact.
Oh, America's Liberty.
And it started as a MER, it ended up in ADR. There was a consultation, and there was a memo, and there was a dismissal on that basis.
We'll look into it further.
Yes. Just to follow up on Commissioner Weintraub's question earlier about the combined coordinated expenditure limit. What was the, do you know, do you have offhand what the coordinated expenditure limit was? The combined one for the national parties and the state party?
Not exactly. I know it was like $98,000 for the state and $98,000 for DSC.
So close to
$200,000. Yeah, there was.
And do you know whether they, did you even check to see what the national party spent?
Yes.
And it was less than their?
Yes. Yeah, there was plenty of cushion.
Plenty of cushion. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Those are my questions at this time, Mr. Chairman. I might want to investigate these issues just a little bit more. Perhaps we could bring it back next week. I think we have one more meeting this
month. One more meeting. That's it. Any further questions, comments at this point to address? Or we'll move this over to the next open session. Thanks. So what do we have next? The next matter, fiscal year 2017 annual FOIA report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Robert Kahn will be coming up and making a brief, give a brief overview. Right here, Robert. But if I could just recognize the hard work that the Administrative Law Division has done this year in the FOIA realm in particular, where we had a record number of requests, a record number of closures, and also a record number of appeals to handle. So my kudos to Robert Kahn, Kate Higginbotham, Candace Sally, Chris Mealy, Hannah Hussein, Steve Hajar, and Pat Washington, and also Peter Hahn just left us, but he certainly did his fair share of the work before we drove him out of here with that workload. And I'll give you, I think I owe it from a legal perspective that, yes, the Moldovans have left. They're no longer here. So I
yes,
want to
correct.
Be the third person to say that at this meeting.
Mr. Chairman, I think they had about as much of this as they could take.
I can see they're just kind of looking at their watch and going like, this is America.
I wanted that on the record. So, Mr. Kahn?
All right.
And that they're still gone, what'd you say?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for having me here. I know I presented this to you guys some time ago, so I'm sure that you may have questions, and I'd be happy to answer them. But just to sort of reemphasize what Greg said, during fiscal year 2017, the agency received a total of 150 FOIA requests, and we closed 134 FOIA requests. Both of those are records for a year for the agency. We also received a total of 8 appeals in fiscal year 2017 and closed 9 appeals, because there's one left over from previous year. Those are also records. The 154 requests was an increase of 16.3% from fiscal year 2016 and an increase of a whopping 64.8% over the number of requests in 2015. And in terms of closures, it was an increase of 15.5% from FY16 and an increase of 65.4% from FY2015. And just to give you a quick snapshot of where the FEC stands in comparison to government-wide stats, and obviously currently, because nothing is public for FY17, I'm just going to be comparing our FY17 to the government calculated by DOJ stats for FY16, but for the simple requests, the FEC's average response time was 14.5 days. Government-wide, it was a little over 28 days. For complex requests, the FY2017 FEC response time was an average of 97.2 days. Government-wide, that response time was 128.5 days. So I'm sure there may be more specific questions that some of you have, and I would be happy to answer anything. Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, yeah, nice work. Do you include some? It seems in the past we learned that the statistics that we receive on ones that are pending are not those ones that are held in abeyance. Is there something? Is there some distinction drawn between those that are waiting for other agencies or not? Is that just some?
Yeah, no. For
thing in my imagination.
No, no. It's a good question. They do ask us to separate. Well, not separate out, but talk individually about FOIA requests that are in consultation with other agencies, but that doesn't toll our clocks. So all of that time is attributed to the FEC for any of those. And there,
if something sits along for a year or two, we count that in our figures and stuff like that.
We do.
It's average. It's averaged in the year. It's actually closed. So if one was pending for 5 years, that gets thrown on, and obviously will bust your average a little bit.
Yep, but if something's open, what do you do? You count the amount of time that's being run while it's sitting, awaiting another. Because it seems to me we'll have one or two that are may never.
We do have several. I mean, it's our policy to. I won't say nag other agencies, but to consistently request updates. We actually. I think I've mentioned this before. We're actually hiring for a new position within the admin law team that would do a lot of the FOIA and privacy work. And one of the gentlemen who we've interviewed who used to work for DOJ said that, that was probably the hardest part of his job was trying to deal with the other agencies. And sometimes that meant going to bosses and bosses, but it really is just that struggle of just trying to get in touch with someone and trying to get a straight answer. But every agency is working through these problems at their own speed, and so for us, we're very quick if DOJ or someone else asks us something, but fortunately, usually the questions to us are relatively simple. We have to rely on the other agencies.
Well, I apologize for not looking at this earlier, but what could we do to inform us whenever we receive a report along this line as to, okay, these much are being held in abeyance, and they've been in abeyance for 5 years or 2 years or 3 months, so that we can at least be sufficiently aware to see if we want to do something about it, or at least just be aware of the fact that they've fallen in a hole and possibly never to be heard from again. But I am also concerned about somebody who has a FOIA request, and we for some reason send over a portion of it to, say, DOJ, and as I understand, we keep the rest until we get it all.
Correct.
And I'm not too sure I'm comfortable with that, because at some point that FOIA requester may be able to get a lot of information for what we might have.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is that not the way it works?
I'm sorry. I was misinterpreting what you were saying. if there is something that needs to be sent out to another agency for consultation, but it's only part of what would be our response, we typically don't wait to send what is just our internal information. So there are a lot of pending FOIA responses. We've sent out at least one interim response. And so I believe on at least a couple of the consults, the only thing that we're waiting for is to hear back from the other agencies. That actually may be true of all the outstanding consults. So, yeah, no, we do try and provide as much information as we can, knowing that it's going to take a little longer if we deal with
Can you let them know that portion of it is being held up because of
another
agency?
Yes, yeah, no, that is definitely part of the cover letter.
Do we ever say that we, I think I know the answer from a previous discussion, but we don't do this, but should we at some point say, we can't do this based upon what we know. We're not going to get this information to go apply yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not something that the FOIA sort of comprehends. I mean, clearly, once you pass the 20-day period for response, a FOIA requester can go to court over that sort of thing, and of course that would get messy because we would be involved. If you're talking about something where another agency is involved, we would have to get them involved somehow. And indeed, we have had recent litigation which has required making sure that we got back FOIA records from another agency so that we could provide that in the course of litigation. So typically, if you tell another agency that there's pending litigation, they go a little faster. But there's nothing that the agency can do to say, okay, you know, we've waited 5 years for, you know, this department to get back to us. It's now out of our hands. It's just part of the process.
But how many cases are pending like that?
I tried to go through everything. I think that in terms of consults, there are either three or four. So it's not that many. It just happens that some of them are the oldest ones we have. When we do get something back from them, it will take off a couple of really old FOIA requests. So that would be very nice.
So you have most of them DOJ?
No, actually, I think. I know that the one that we've been waiting the most on is with the State Department, and I believe we have several there. And I don't want to, I'm not trying to point them out, but they are routinely regarded as sort of the department that takes the longest time. And you can sort of understand it based on the fact that, I mean, I know we sent them stuff that was in Thai and in Spanish, and, you know, someone has to translate that. So it's just, you know, it's part of the puzzle. Sometimes that's what happens. But we have, actually, on the oldest one, we have gotten something like, I think it was like 600, 700 pages back from them, so we're just waiting for about 30 or 40 more pages. So we're very close, but...
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, I understood it completely. I thought you said there are four outstanding like this. But then you said several with the State Department.
Yeah, and I may not have all of them. I tried to go through all of this. It's one, two of the State Departments.
And one had, like, I think, wasn't the one with several other agencies?
Yeah, there's currently one that we had to send to 14 different agencies, and I think we've gotten five back. But I think in terms of these old, well, in terms of any of the backlogged, So in terms of the backlogged FOIAs, there are four that are on consult, three of them to the State Department, one to the Office of Management and Budget. It's, as I said, we've definitely gotten stuff from both of those before. It's just a matter of waiting for them and, you know, being relatively consistent about reminding them that, oh, yeah, we have something pending with you.
Do we ever notify their question to say, are you still interested?
Yes.
Good, because I just wonder if maybe
we've actually
gone, and
I think we've actually been able to cross one of the ones that was in the agency statistics that we sent to you at the end of FY17 that's already been closed based on a still interested letter. So, yeah, we do try and do that. Sometimes we're successful. Other times we're able to further narrow what they're looking for, which can be very helpful.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Goodman.
Greg, you said that in our averages for completing requests, a FOIA request completion doesn't go into that number until it's completed?
Correct, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So if we have old outstanding FOIA requests, they aren't in our averages yet.
That's correct.
So when they are completed, our average is probably going to shoot up.
It's going to shoot up, absolutely.
So our average on a complex request right now is 458 days?
Fine, is that correct?
I'm looking at page, I don't see page numbers.
No, there probably aren't.
It's D, section D of the report?
Yeah, so the report actually gets submitted via an online web page. This is just a printout.
But the average for a complex one is 458
mm-hmm.
days?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And on simple ones, it's 294 days?
Yeah.
Okay. And in looking at the 10 oldest pending requests before the agency, I see requests going back to 2011 that have not been completed, and that's 1,583 days.
Correct. Yeah.
And I see the one.
And that one is with the State Department. Just
I was going to walk through that. And one is goes back 1,014 days, and you say four of the. So you've given the report requires us to give the 10 oldest requests, right?
Yeah.
Right, Greg? Okay.
Yes.
So four of those are pending other agencies' consultations.
I believe so. The one from OMB may not have gotten to its place on the 10th oldest.
So number 11 still might be a pretty old one waiting OMB?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's certainly possible.
So you think of this oldest 10, there might be three that are held up because they're awaiting the State Department review?
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to go back to
you can't identify which ones of these.
I know the oldest one is.
So the one that was dated June, we have a FOIA request dated June 9, 2011. That's one, as of the date this report was written, was 1,583 days old, and that's held up at the State Department.
Correct.
Does that mean we have probably produced some records?
Oh, yeah, we've produced a lot of records.
Of the 10 oldest pending FOIA requests, can you identify the others that are held up at the State Department?
Okay. Let's see. It looks like, from my records, that it's only two of them, and it would be the oldest and the 10th oldest.
Meaning the one dated August 7, 2013?
Correct.
Okay, so eight of our old cases here are not awaiting another agency's consultation?
That is my understanding, yes.
We have a request dated October 18, 2012. It's over 1,200 days old. Do you know offhand who that is?
Yes. It is a request for documents related to contracts for our IT systems, and it's from, I assume, an attorney from Holland & Knight.
Why haven't we concluded it?
I don't know. I can't answer that right here. With a lot of these, there has been a bottleneck that, as I said, we're hiring someone to be specifically in charge of FOIA and Privacy Act processes.
I'm sorry, and I thought, Greg, who currently is in charge of the FOIA operation?
I am, and Kate's our main point person, but we're bringing in a devoted staff person who would help us, because right now all my staff have to do countless other things throughout the day, and we don't have anyone who's 100% devoted to the FOIA and Privacy Act. We're doing all kinds of other things. And then my understanding about the IT contracts is that there has been some difficulty culling together all the information from other sources, from our CFO's office, etc. There's been some hang-ups there. So,
okay. Robert, you sounds like you have the list. What's the July 25th, 2013 request for?
Yeah, that is an ongoing request about all materials and documents related to MER-6234. Off the top of my head, I can't remember which one that is.
Have we closed MER-6234? Do you know?
I believe we have. This is a request from Mr. McGinley.
Okay.
Yes, that's the yes.
Have we made a partial production to Mr. McGinley?
He has received quite a lot of stuff.
I think
yes.
I'm assuming it's
somebody else by now.
Well, yeah,
that's one of the problems.
That is a question.
I think it was a pretty significant production, if I recall.
That
particular.
I'm sorry.
If I'm remembering which one. That relates to that. I think there's been a significant production.
Yes,
okay.
There was.
Has there been a partial production?
Exactly. Yeah.
Has there been a partial production on the contracts for IT to the Holland & Knight requester?
I believe so, but I can check.
Okay. August 7, 2013, pending over 1,039 days. What was the subject of that one?
Right. So that one is all records to and from Congress since January 1st, 2009 regarding any pending enforcement actions. So my understanding of that is that it's a matter of collecting all of those records.
They'd be here in the agency, right?
They would, yeah.
We haven't been able to collect those in 1,039 days?
I don't know.
Okay.
All I have here is that it's just pending. My feeling is that we've certainly collected some.
Have we made partial production on that one?
That I don't know. I would assume so, but I can, of course, get back to you on that as well.
August, there are three requests on August 7. Are they all the same or from the same requester?
No. I will go through. They are the same requester.
Okay, same request, but different subjects.
Yeah, different subjects. So one is a request for anything with the, well, a request of disciplinary records that had certain particular keywords. Another
employee disciplinary records?
I assume so.
I mean, why wouldn't we just deny that under an exemption to FOIA?
I don't know.
And close it.
Right. No, I see where you're going. I do. I don't know exactly whether that was just stuff that can be easily denied. My feeling is that it couldn't, or it would have been off of here quickly. Mm-hmm. There's another one, and again, the list that I have is not does not make direct quotes from what they requested, but it's records related to the development of policies and procedures. So I don't know how general that was. Another was requesting records about various studies, evaluations related to use of the internet.
You're talking about these are all the August 7?
I'm just going down the list. Yeah.
What date are we on now, August?
We're still on the 7th.
Okay, we're still on one requester on the 7th.
Yeah.
Studies on the internet? You mean political speech on the internet? Or
that has been a subject of discussion. Let's see. We're talking about now 8:23. There have been a couple that have had multiple interim releases, but dealt with the connection with the IRS and nonprofit political activities that was sort of covered.
Which date is that one? Is that the August 23rd?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Does this go back to, for lack of a better term, are these requests about the
Lois Lerner,
the focus on consultations between this agency, Department of Justice, and IRS?
It wasn't consultations, but it was part of the whole set of requests going as far as the congressional requests and subpoenas about any and all information that the FEC had related to Ms. Lerner. As I recall, this request was asking for some of that information that was generated by us in response to the congressional requests, but it appears that there is still a little more to that.
We have other documents, regarding?
We made our responses to Congress, and I think that fulfilled everything that they wanted. I'm not sure. It appears that whatever this requester wanted was different enough that it wasn't part of whatever we were able to provide Congress.
Okay. There may be other Lois Lerner documents in the building. Is that what we're saying?
No, I don't think so. Because, at least, again, from what I have here, it is not specific to Lois Lerner.
Oh, okay.
So it may have included other interactions with
between
the IRS.
Between this agency and the IRS?
Yeah.
Okay, interactions with the IRS. Yeah. And you think we've made some partial?
From my records, we've made at least 4 interim releases of documents to that requester.
Okay. 8/28/2013?
Yes, that is pending with the State Department.
That one's a State Department?
Yeah, and we have made one interim release. Just in terms of reading, this is something that...
By the way, I'm sorry, Robert.
Yeah.
I'm seeing in the 10 oldest requests, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 requests, all dated August 7, 2013. but they're out of order.
Right. So this is actually something that Commissioner Weintraub and Tom Moore had noticed, too. The problem, and this is something that Candace Sally has to talk to OIP about every year because it's a little tricky, but some of them had tolling. So the request by the this chart is created by OIP. And so they want it in a very particular format. And so they want it by number of days pending. And these are pending perfected requests.
Yes.
So some of them got tolled for some period of time.
I see. So they're not as old in our hopper from the date of perfection.
Correct.
Understood. Now, yeah. if I move off the oldest 10 list.
Yeah.
By the way, when were these dates calculated? These days, 1014, 1000. Were these date? Are these the outstanding days as of today, or as of a month or two ago?
Well, this is as of the end of FY17, so
September
30th.
So you could add almost 60 days onto all these day numbers here at this point. Okay, and so when we conclude any of these. Our average number of days of 450, I take it all these would be considered complex requests?
Yeah.
Okay. So our average number of days of 458 is actually much higher than 458 when you start adding in these 10 as well as the, I take it we have some that are around 1,000 days old that haven't even made the top 10 list.
Let's see. Let me just look at the scores.
Yeah. We have probably.
It's probably an accurate statement. It's close.
It'll definitely have an adverse impact, particularly on the average for complex matters, because for overall, we obviously have the benefit of the simple ones that we can close out within a couple of days. You could offset a couple of long ones, but in the complex bunch, you know, that average is going to take even a bigger hit. You're correct.
So the real average. I mean, I understand this is an accurate average given the methodology of this report, but if you were to expand that methodology to add into the average number of days pending for matters that have been closed and that are still open. Our average is probably going to be closer to 600 days, maybe 2 years.
That's possible. Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask about another number,
I'm sorry. Yes. Were you specifically talking about that chart at D, the pending?
Yeah, I was looking at 458, trying to understand. Yeah. How number interfaces with these 10 longest cases.
Right. So what that chart is for every pending perfected request that we currently have that's pending. So it does not include anything we closed over the course of FY17.
Oh, yeah.
So the 458
is closed matters.
No, actually, those are all open. They're all pending.
So the 10 oldest are in the 458 number.
Yes, correct.
Well, that's helpful to know.
Correct.
Good.
Yeah,
okay.
Good. Yeah.
Then let me ask about a couple pages earlier. I guess it's under Roman numeral 6, section C, 10 oldest pending administrative appeals.
Yes.
And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 old appeals. Well, one's not too old.
right.
But we have some 2000. Are those pending before the commission?
No. The reason we've kept them is because and the commission has dealt with each of the appeals. But with some of them, the determination ended up being that we would continue producing documents on those underlying FOIA requests. So the appeal remains open in that
until
sense.
We complete the request?
Correct.
And we have one that's 1,403? where an appeal was granted and we still haven't completed document production?
Is that the McGinley one?
I believe so.
Yeah.
So Mr. McGinley appealed, won his appeal, and hasn't got all of his documents.
No, it's more complicated than that. That one I would put in the category of it's up to us to, and we've tried to in various ways, just try to confirm that it's closed. If there's any, because I don't believe there's anything else left for us to produce.
Is that the same case with some of these others? I get that one. That one may be closed, and we just haven't officially closed it on the books.
Yeah, and there was a failure. None of the motions on that appeal had four votes, so it's in a kind of sui generis.
Is that in the same as some of these other old appeals that we think they're completed, or are we still working on some of those other appeals to provide the documents?
I can't give you an answer for all of the or for the those three other ones that are over 13 days. Mm-hmm. I do know that there is one of them that I am working on where yes, there is still we questioned whether the requester still wanted more documents. This is Neil Reif was the requester, and we're still going through everything. And you know, most of the time, the length of the process is not necessarily in terms of gathering the documents, but it's in terms of reviewing them and applying the redactions and going through the legal process. So I believe that's where we are on that one.
One last question, Mr. Chairman. Do I owe you any documents right now on any open FOIA request? I've been pretty good about responding to Mr. Hajar. But
I do not believe so.
Okay. Let me know if I do.
And indeed, thank you to Commissioner Peterson for and Theo for being proactive and making sure that they knew what they needed to get to us, and we were able to figure some of that stuff out. No, I believe that in terms of requests waiting for something from the commissioners, the number is near zero. I'd have to go back and make a complete look, but yeah, we're not, as far as I can tell, we're not waiting on you guys for, if it is, it's for one or two cases. And, you know, I mean, that's on us to remind you. So we'll do that.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I just so the commission knows, I mean, we've, the better part of Robert and I's work week is focusing on the backlog and different ways to address it. And of course, you know, one of the number one plan that we had a while back that will come to fruition shortly is that dedicated staff for FOIA and Privacy Act matters, which we believe will help considerably. You know, and like I said, I mean, it's going to be a quarter-by-quarter thing, but, you know, it's certainly our goal to keep on improving and putting the resources necessary to chip away at it. So, you know, we appreciate the Commission's interest and support in doing that. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Peterson.
Yeah, thank you. We're certainly, on the commission level, certainly not oblivious to the avalanche that you are often under in terms of the numbers of the requests, not only the sheer numbers of the requests, but the complexity of many of them and the document-intensive nature of many of them and sometimes the extent of these searches that have to be undertaken. And it's always a case that when you're trying to dig yourself out of a hole and dirt keeps on getting dumped in by the shovel load, it's a daunting task. And I know that that you and Ms. Higginbotham have been engaged in a very difficult undertaking and a very labor-intensive undertaking. But the efforts that that you make in this field are much appreciated. It's a difficult it's a difficult situation that you're in because again of the sheer volume and I just wanted to note the efforts that you've made and the appreciation that I have for those efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further? No, I'll join in that. I think you do a very good job considering the amount of requests that come into us. And I think to me, some of the volume of the requests, some requests require so much information that I don't see how you get it done. I did have one question, though. Weren't we going to get some equipment that was going to help really speed this up? And you've got another person coming, and is that going to be enough to keep you going for a couple of years? Or what do you mean?
In fact, we are just, as part of our non-FOIA duties in admin law, we're just going through hopefully the last review of the contract for the software, the e-discovery software that we'll be using to process a lot of the FOIA requests, ones that request emails, which is a large number of them. We'll finally have a dedicated system to doing that. It seems like from talking with OCIO, they're very excited about its ease of use. And I know we're very excited about being able to gather the quantities of requested documents in a relatively quick fashion and have it all in front of us so we can go through it and do our reviews. So yeah, that is another thing that should really help us, and I expect that that will assist us in our backlog as well.
So person power, how are we doing then?
Person power, as Greg
said.
You notice
I'm getting sensitized here.
Yeah, as Greg said, we're going to have someone who's a dedicated FOIA responder, and the people we're interviewing all have significant experience in handling FOIA backlogs. So I'm really excited about that, that they'll have some good experience coming in, knowing how to help an agency get through some of this stuff. So next year, hopefully, this list will be a lot shorter, and maybe there won't even be 10 oldest cases. But we'll see.
Well, there will always be 10 oldest.
Well,
it's all relative.
That's okay.
10 oldest backlog. Right. Anyway. Yeah.
Hopefully, there'll be three numbers and not four days in the numbers, yes.
We'll do our best.
The other part of the equation is currently, and granted, it's only for this 3-month period when Kate isn't here, but we're down Ms. Higginbotham, and of course Mr. Hahn just left, so we're down another attorney too. But my feeling is that when Kate returns, and especially when we hire this new person, which I assume will be early in the calendar year, as early as we can get it, then we'll be at essentially full strength.
But you'll be at the same person power strength because you're losing one, adding one, but you need more. I guess that was what.
Yes. It would be slightly more.
And based on my assessment of the resources necessary to do all of our responsibilities, I do feel like that we would definitely want to replace the staff attorney who left in addition to the newly created position to be in a position to put a dent in our numbers. Because for someone, and this is not an excuse, but like a year and a half ago and beyond, I mean, we had two staff attorneys for a while there, and you know, the impact of that was pretty devastating for a lot of the programs. So I want to stay away from getting in that position again.
Thanks. Anything further? I think there was one matter that I had just asking for the... Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the Commission may consider the late submission of agenda documents number 1753A, 1753B, and 1753C.
I think this was an item that I added, asked to be put on the agenda, and I'm going to make 5 minutes out of this because I know we're cut right big time into lunchtime and perhaps the rest of the day. What I'm asking is that the Office of General Counsel include the kind of the material that has been presented coming out of our office on enforcement, most of which is already in a lot of the information that's provided. But that also it would be redacted so that the public could also have the benefit of that information. If there's some particular concerns, I'd be glad to address those and bring them up at a later date. But I just wanted to get this out for consideration. Would people prefer to go to lunch right now? and we don't have to...
I think lunch is always in order, but no, I just had a quick question. Mr. Chairman, I first of all, I commend you in terms of the efforts that you make in order to try to move things along. I know that it's been a consistent emphasis and theme of yours, and I think that is very helpful. In terms of the motion to amend the directive, I think that there's nothing immediately that stands out that says that puts up alarm bells, but I have to admit I haven't been able to study it out with as much specificity as maybe I'd like. And certainly I think it would be helpful for me to maybe for us to have some discussions offline and maybe even get the input of the Office of General Counsel about this. And so I think I wouldn't be prepared to vote on anything today. But I do want to give it serious consideration, and like I said, I again want to commend you for your efforts to keep Thanks. The workload moving.
Thanks. So we'll put this off till next open session. Hopefully, we can. Any questions? Let me know. I got a little bit bogged down recently, so I'm a little bit behind the eight ball on some of this myself. But this time, I guess we're done with the closed session. Are there any management or administrative matters?
Mr. Chairman, there are no such matters.
Okay, thank you. Adjourned.